The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, this is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Where did you come from? Why are you here? Where are you going? Have you ever wondered about the purpose of your own private existence? You probably have, but the time you spent wondering about it has been one of the smallest little instances in your entire life, it's more than likely. Most people are rather defeated when they try to discover a real purpose in life, especially when they look at educators, scientists, historians, philosophers, and even theologians telling them that such an answer to such a question is absolutely impossible. Is evolution true? Does evolution offer any absolute proofs about the origin of the universe, about the origin of life, and about the present-day course of the human species? Does it offer any solution to the present-day problems of the world? On the other hand, does theology offer any solutions? You can go down to Piccadilly Circus on any busy night, and you'll probably see some person with a great large sign walking up and down. I was there with my wife some years ago, and I saw someone with a sign on his back or holding it up saying, "Flee from the wrath to come." Or maybe saying, "The coming of the Lord is drawing near." Like as not, you'll run across some person on a street corner where he's holding forth outside some very, very, maybe chic entertainment place, and all of the lords and ladies or the other people are coming out, and he's saying, "Repent ye," and so on. He's screaming and shouting about religion. Everybody's embarrassed and wondering what kind of a nut is this. The average person really does wonder just who has the answers today. On the one hand, you have millions of people who, by habit, go to church. Church-going, professing Christian people who live according to certain principles, at least, well, some of them do. I know that many pastors will disagree with that. Many pastors are saying increasingly that a lot of people go to church and act Christian all of a few minutes on the weekend, and then the rest of the week they live exactly as they please and as if there were no God at all. And of course, even theologians are beginning to say that God is dead today, are asking the question, who was Christ? But you know, even though a lot of what you would call theology may look a little bit trite in this modern world, this modern space age, where would you go for a solution to the biggest questions in your private life? You know the conditions in the world are real. You look at world conditions and they're a little bit staggering. And if you're like most people, you don't like to look at them very long. You don't like the news you hear any more than I do. You're probably unhappy over the possibility that in the United States, growing drought and famine might cause tremendous crop shortages. You're probably unhappy over governmental situations, over the race issues and the potential threat of more and more race violence in the big cities. You're unhappy over the educational system, over your wages. It's been proved that fully 90-some-odd percent of all the people who were polled by a famous pollster not long ago said yes, they thought true happiness would be as a result of a 30% increase in their wages. And so if you're like most people, you like to have the world shut up and keep out and just live your own private life and try not to think about it. It's evident in our music today, even in our plays and motion pictures. "Stop the world, I want off," one of them says. And that's about the way people are living. They find the world is a pretty unhappy, horrifying place. Riots, violent overthrow of government, burnings, muggings, rapings, robbings and stabbings here and there. All around the world, the emerging new nations that want to leap suddenly into prominence and to take up the position of the elder nations of this modern era, and to do so almost overnight when they have little more than a flagpole on which to fly their banner. A world replete with problems and with an absolute plethora of solutions. So where do we go from here? Have you ever sat back to analyze your own private existence and to ask yourself, where will you be, say, 5 years from now? The future is rather insecure to most people. Where will you be 10 years from now? What about 20? What will you be teaching your children and grandchildren? Anything on which to base their lives? Is there any sense or reason anymore to going to get an education? Becoming a specialist in one direction or another? Deciding to take up some responsible position as a direct contributor to your own society? To help in some way, whatever that means, to help? No one seems to know, but to help who? Help what? Help your own society? Your own part of the world? You know, very few people sit back to ask themselves, who am I? What am I? Why do I exist? What does my life consist of? Where am I going? You see, evolutionists have many, many specializations, and not everyone will study every aspect of it. One man might study one tiny aspect of it. It would be like taking this giant tree, which incidentally has no trunk and no roots, but anyhow, here's this giant tree, beginning with the first major branches, let's say. And it's a dead tree, but it has all these millions of branches and little twigs. And here's a person who decides to go very, very deeply into this one little twig. So he studies comparative embryology. And he finds out that at one stage or another, polywogs, chicken, human beings, or maybe horses all look the same. And this is very profound to him. The idea that they all become polywogs, chickens, horses, or men doesn't seem to really matter. But the fact that at a certain stage in the embryonic development, they do look a little bit alike, this is profound, and so he delves very, very deeply into this one little twig. And he thinks he really has discovered something profound. Then there are those who deal with the broad scope of the origin of the entirety of the universe, and what they say is a little bit remarkable, too. Now, before I again ask a few embarrassing questions of evolution, let me tell you this. As shocking as it sounds, I can prove to anyone who has an open mind and who is not a spiritual coward and who is not afraid of the truth that there is an all-wise divine creator God, that there are solutions already laid out in advance for the perplexing mountainous problems of mankind today, that humankind is destined to survive, that a world, a new era of vast development and discovery, a world of rehabilitation, of re-education, a world of law, of order, of harmony, of beauty, a world of brotherhood among races and nations, a world of vast productivity and growing gross national product, or should I say world or international product, that world is portrayed, is pictured in all places in the Bible. Now, wait a minute, before you say, oh, come on, because a lot of people about this time are saying that. You're not welcome to say it. You don't have it coming to you if you don't know the Bible. And if you don't know the Bible, don't try to tell me or anybody else he doesn't know what he's talking about until you study the Bible and read it for yourself and find out what it says. I got a letter not long ago, a very irate evolutionist who assumed I hadn't studied evolution, who assumed I knew virtually nothing about evolution. And he took great exception to something that I said when I was asking questions about dizzy woodpeckers or about leaping various reptiles who were trying to grow wings out of their scales. And I had a kick out of that. Well, I was talking about the fact that evolution does not propose that these creatures suddenly developed their complete organisms or their mechanisms to adapt to their present environment. And I was explaining so by the very fact that it takes a fully developed wing, a fully developed airframe, a fully developed air sac and little sacs throughout the entire body of birds, which are filled by their lungs. The fact that birds don't sweat, the fact that they have a fantastic and a rapid metabolism, they have a little eggshell thin skull and great huge eyes and a tiny brain, that they have these fantastic guidance systems and the like, and that nobody is going to fly unless all of that is perfectly and fully developed and he is able to fly at one time or another, anciently, if evolution is true, which it is not, and I can prove it. A reptile, which was almost a reptile, but not quite, a bird which was almost a bird, but not quite, had to fly. And the first attempt had to be successful or else he broke his fool neck jumping off a cliff. Now, this evolutionist got the idea that I was trying to say that evolution purports that these reptiles broke their necks jumping off cliffs, or that the woodpeckers got wrenching headaches and died of broken beaks, or of broken necks, or of dizziness. And you can see the forest floor and these woodpeckers with their little claws straight up clutching, you know, lying all over the forest floor. And they didn't even survive. I said nothing of the sort. I'm only proving the point that evolution does not say that it was developed suddenly. And I am pointing out that unless it was developed suddenly, and unless it was a complete airframe and able to fly, it didn't fly. And if it didn't fly, then there aren't any birds, and you and I are both insane. But there are birds, and birds do fly, and birds are designed to fly. So I've been talking about the physical environment all around us, which the Bible says we should talk about, which Romans, the first chapter, points out as the greatest proofs of an invisible God. Now let's go back to the very beginning of it all. I can prove God exists. I can prove the origin of life. I can prove to you, if you will write for the booklets and the articles I announce, and you can prove it to yourself, better said, and God will prove it to you if you will let him, if you will open your mind and open your Bible and maybe get rid of some preconceived ideas and a lot of anti-supernatural bias and prejudice and begin to look into it for yourself. Now let's talk, for the sake of at least one evolutionist I know of who's a little nettled with me, about the most up-to-the-moment claims concerning the origin of the universe itself. You know, the origin of the universe is a question that is one of the biggest question marks of all. A man called Patrick Moore, who is prominent in England on BBC, and whose article appeared in The Listener in December of 1965, was writing on this very subject about the evolving universe. Now, this man believes in evolution. He is an evolutionist, and he does believe in the evolving universe, but this is what he says. And he's quite noted in the field, and this is very, very up to date. Of all the scientific problems, he said, facing mankind, that of the origin of the universe is the most fascinating. You bet it is. Then he went on to say, whether it can ever be fully solved remains to be seen, and we are unable to understand what is meant by the, quote, very beginning, end quote. And what's more, my friend, you're unable to understand what is meant by out, up, away, forever, eternity, endless. You do not understand those terms. Your mind rebels at them. You can't divide 100 by thirds. You don't understand the term infinity. Time, space, they're all the same. Trying to dope them out and to understand them really drives some people a little bit nutty sometimes. And some have done just about that to their own minds in trying to wonder and to ponder these things out, because the human mind is limited, and limited by a great power that has actually set a governor on the human mind and deliberately limited human understanding and human powers for a great and a specific purpose. But this man went on to say, if the universe came into existence at a set moment in time, then what was happening at an earlier period? Now, all of this is the idea that all of this might have happened without a God. This is the evolutionary idea. If the universe came into existence at a set moment in time, then what was happening at an earlier period? That's what I've been asking. And that is the question. And evolutionists state the question, and they'll state the question, and restate the question, and then they'll print the question, they'll talk about the question, and it's still a question. They never answer it. And if we assume that the universe has always existed, we are forced, he said, into trying to imagine a period of time which had no beginning. And that's a very unsettling thing to anybody, isn't it? Because to us as rational creatures relevant to this earth, measuring in terms of gravity and of the gravitational and magnetic pulls upon us, we talk about stone in Britain or a number of pounds that we weigh, which is only measuring gravitational pull upon our bodies, in talking in terms of meters or feet, of miles or kilometers, of yards or in measurements and so on, we try to have some relationship to understand time, distance, space, weight, and to get some relationship in this physical world and the environment of ours. Time is something that escapes us. Trying to think about the beginning without a divine creator who did begin it, who has lived forever, something that defies our minds, and yet there is a way to prove that is the only answer, and a way to inevitably march up to the point where you must come to the conclusion that any other answer is the biggest bubble of idiocy you have ever seen in your life, and is illogical as anything could be. Now here's what this most up-to-the-moment report on the evolving universe said. In the 1930s, the evolutionary theory of the universe was worked out. On this pattern, all the material was created at one moment in what may be called a primeval atom. This giant primeval atom exploded, and general expansion began. Now, I've always been interested in that theory, because an explosion, we know, we can try to tell you exactly what it is, but no one really can. They don't really know, so far as trying to decide what it is that causes one element to work upon another in that fashion. what causes some volatile giving off of light, of heat, of energy, of gases? What causes the breakup of solid matter into tiny pieces and causes all the molecules and atoms to violently collide and explode and go out in all directions? Well, they can write it up in scientific-sounding words, but just because they try to hang a rather inadequate label on it does not mean they invented it. Now, where did all this force come from? Where did those giant blobs of matter come from? You look at the galaxies out here, at stars that are many, many thousands of times even bigger than our sun, and our sun is so much bigger than the Earth, there's no comparison, and it begins to overwhelm you a little bit. So they have the Big Bang Theory. Now, he concluded in this article about the oscillating universe, and I want to quote, "The one vital fact is that the universe exists," he summarized. "The material in the galaxies, the stars, the Earth, human beings, and the kitchen sink must have come from somewhere." Amen to that. "All modern hypotheses start from either a moment of creation in the remote past or else with a universe which already exists. There has been no attempt to explain how the material came into being in the first place." Exactly my point. But there should be such an attempt, and there is only one way to explain it. And any other direction is not true science and is not rational and is not logical. Now, he went on to say, "And in this respect, the evolutionary theories, oscillating and otherwise, are as inadequate as the steady state. What we are discussing is not the origin of the universe, but the development of the universe, which is a different thing. No doubt we shall gain much more information during the years to come, but," he said, "at the moment, we have to confess that our ignorance of the actual creation is more or less complete." I didn't say it. I didn't say it. He did. And I do agree. I really do agree that so far as evolutionists are concerned, their ignorance of the actual creation, of the origin of the universe, is complete. It's complete ignorance, because they don't have any answer. That's why I've been asking questions, because I notice that sometimes leading atheists and evolutionists like to ask embarrassing questions of theologians. And they try to say, "Well, now, how do you know God exists?" And then usually somebody will say, "Well, I sort of feel that he does. I've had an experience. I just sense that God exists. I have faith." Well, the evolutionist has a better faith than that. In other words, if faith is judged or measured by the vastness, the broad missing facts that you don't have in your possession, and that's where faith comes in, then you've got to admit the evolutionist has a lot more faith than a lot of theologians. The theologian has proof, if he would just look to the proof, which God says he should, all about him. Now, to show you some more of these proofs, what about the early warning systems in some insects? Let's try to imagine how evolution could have created these things based upon some experiments made. And they pointed out certain species had developed early warning systems against aggressors. And in agriculture and architecture, millions of years before intelligent man appeared on the earth. Now, that's always the way they state it. I don't agree with that, and I can prove otherwise, but be that as it may, that's what they claim, that they developed these systems. Now, let's just see if that is plausible, because you and I both know that the first one had to be successful. You can think that maybe this insect thought he needed one, and along came this bird and gobbled him up before he had it, and he wasn't able to detect the bird was there. But maybe you can surmise he laid some eggs, and maybe just the fact that he sort of began to think, and we know insects don't think, that he needed it, maybe his eggs got the idea. Or her eggs, baby, better said. And then as the eggs hatched, well, they thought about it a little longer. And maybe they got gobbled up before they even hatched. Well, maybe they did hatch. Maybe they all died because they didn't have early warning systems. And maybe none of them survived, so there aren't any insects. Is that the way we understand it? Well, you know, at the annual meeting of the National Academy of Sciences, a Dr. Carol Williams of Harvard University said that the next leap forward, that's an interesting word, because oftentimes the layman assumes that the geneticist or the person in the biological sciences who is studying evolution and its various ramifications says that there were no leaps. And yet they do say there are leaps, and there are wide and varying ideas about evolution among evolutionists themselves. They do not all agree at all. One book will say one thing and have its proponents, and those who accept it in another book will say quite something else and say that this is my hypothesis, and other people will begin to support that theory. It is still a theory. Now then, they said the next leap forward in biology might be understanding of how that complicated computer, the central nervous system of animals, performs. Insects are good subjects for study because in the 500 million years since they evolved from lowlier forms, whatever those were, I mean, what's lowlier than a fly? Let's face it, what is more lowly than a dirty, rotten fly buzzing around your mouth? You're trying to bat it away. What are we talking about, lowly? Gnats? What's lowlier than a fly? A worm? They're pretty thoroughly developed. Without worms, you couldn't grow crops. Without worms, you wouldn't have the aeration and the cleaning up of the soil. Well, you can put a batch of worms around in a sandy sort of a soil. It isn't worth a hang. You couldn't grow a thing in it. And in a few months' time, you'll have very fertile soil. Now, what's ineffective and lowly about a worm? If we didn't have worms, we couldn't live. Anyhow, they talk about lowlier forms, whatever those are. Now, they have achieved incredible miniaturization of the parts. That's interesting. And the number of parts which make up their central nervous system. These flying machines, Dr. Williams said, are fantastic examples of biological engineering. Interesting way to put it. They come into the world, for example, with their computers pre-programmed. And they aren't computers, remember, at all, but a tremendous sensory system inside little tiny insects that makes them have a sensitivity in a completely different area than even human beings. For example, every action a fly will have to take to operate efficiently in the environment into which it has been born has been prescribed in advance. But flies are kind of dumb. As a matter of fact, one professor spent 15 years trying to educate them. Now, that's kind of funny in a way when you stop to think. A lot of people don't spend 10 minutes a day trying to educate their own children. They will spend a lot of time preparing a dog for a show or trying to break a parrot of evil speech. But educating our children, here was a man who spent 15 years trying to teach a fly. Now, he found out it wasn't the same fly because I don't think flies live that long. It must have been a whole succession of flies. He's got these flies for years and years. He's trying to teach them, and they're so dumb. Listen to this. These flies would have starved to death. Now, here's intelligent man, which, in a sense, would sort of be a type of a creator. Intelligent man interfering in these little creatures, trying to get something into their dumb head. Now, let's just look at this experiment for a moment and see if it makes sense in the light of what they claim about insects over millions of years evolving fantastic early warning systems to protect themselves from birds and to survive. He spent, this American scientist, 15 years on and off trying to educate flies. He rigged up a little miniature tiny bar, which, if pressed by the fly, would reveal a little bit of food. The flies, though physically able to press the bar, never tumbled to the fact that doing so would earn them a meal. Not in 15 years, all these flies couldn't get it through their head. Punishment for failure. And he punished them by shocking them. Now, isn't that... this is so hilarious, it kind of breaks me up. Punishment for failure in the form of a slight shock did not help. He even punished them when they didn't fly over there and walk along that bar. And he found absolutely no evidence that it was possible to teach a fly anything. As a matter of fact, he found that cockroaches make far better pupils than flies and appear to be the brightest insects of all. You see the lengths to which people will go to try to prove evolution? It's real interesting. But with them, as with other insects, it's innate or pre-programmed behavior, he found, that really counts and not learned behavior. So let me point it out that here is a scientist of certain intelligence who is trying to teach a fly or a cockroach and is interfering, and so draw the analogy of a creator or someone of a far greater and a vast intelligence compared to a fly, trying to teach a fly through I don't know how many generations over a span of 15 years to press a simple lever to get some food to survive. Now, I don't know whether he let the flies die of starvation and then put another fly in from the same brood or let them lay an egg somewhere else. I don't know for sure. But at any rate, he did try to teach them and found out they couldn't learn. Yet, are we to assume then that these moths who have developed a counter-sonar system to jam the radar of bats did so by gradual millions of years of just sort of needing to do so? You can't teach a fly how to obtain his own food, but a moth can begin to gradually evolve a kind of a nerve cell in each ear that can give him an early warning, and he can start running away a lot faster than the bat can get there. Now, it interests the scientists to find out that a moth's computer translate meager intelligence from only a couple of nerve cells into the appropriate muscular action. He's got a better chance of learning from the moth how central nervous systems work than from the vastly more complicated human being, at least so scientists claim. How about that? These early warning systems, guidance systems in birds and insects. The sonar, or the radar, perhaps it should be called, that is used by bats to locate their prey. It is really fantastic, and it had to be fully developed for the first bat that went around trying to find his way around flying completely wide open in the dark, knocked his brains out against a tree and didn't survive. Or flew straight into the ground or something else and just didn't survive. But they've experimented, and as long as they don't tape the bat's mouth shut, he can emit those sharp squeaks, a very high frequency beyond your range of hearing, and the sound bouncing back to his ears warn him of the approaching object, or even let him zero in on insects flying in the air, and that's the way he feeds. It's fantastic, and he had to have it fully developed instantaneously, or he didn't even get his first meal. Now, you may think that's not scientific. Oh, but it is. Very, very scientific, and very, very difficult for any scientist to gainsay or to say otherwise. And they have no answers. Let me quote again at the conclusion of this program before I announce these articles on the origin of life, giants on the earth, and the booklets on Does God Exist and the proof of the Bible, what this man said about the origin of the universe. He said, at the moment, we, and that means evolutionists, those who study the origin of the universe, try to explain your being, your life, your mind, and your existence here without a God. He said, we must confess that our ignorance of the actual creation is more or less complete. Now, that's his confession, not mine. I know who created the universe. I know who gives me every breath of air I breathe. I know who is working out a purpose in my life and in every human life on this earth who will submit to him. I know exactly what this world is going to be like in the next 15 or 20 years because God Almighty lays it right out before me in his word. And you can find the same truth if you are not a spiritual coward. And if you're willing to look into it for yourself without somebody else twisting your arm or telling you a lot of preconceived notions which you're supposed to swallow just because you belong to this or that segment of society or theology or something else. It's about time you quit believing what your parents, relatives, and neighbors might have told you and look into a few things for yourself. And you can do so by writing for these articles on the origin of life, on giants on the earth, because this deals with fossil men, the Neanderthal man, the Piltdown man hoax, the Java and the Peking man, and Zinjanthropus africanus and others. The origin of life, answering the question, where did life come from? And the booklets, Does God Exist? And the proof of the Bible. They're free of charge, no price, and the Plain Truth magazine will come along automatically. 52 pages, full color throughout, and no price, no follow-up, no request for money, and you won't be sent a bill. And just because you write for it doesn't mean you're obligated. No one's going to call upon you. There's no follow-up. It's absolutely free of charge to you. Your subscription has been paid. That's The Plain Truth, the world's unique magazine, and absolutely without charge to you. So write for it by sending your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure you list the call letters of your station, listen to them carefully, and jot them down. First of all, we want to know where you heard the program, so jot down the call letters of your station, and then write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. The address again in just a moment, and so until next time in the series, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.